Did you know that the 4th of July is on a Thursday this year? That's going to be a full weekend of fun out on the deck, 4 days. But if your deck isn't what it used to be and you aren't using it for great family gatherings, you need to call my friends at All Weather Decks. All Weather Decks is a 24-time winner of the Angie Super Service Award. And they probably help one of your neighbors. Click on the map link at allweatherdecks.net. Call All Weather Decks today at 913-206-1974 or go to allweatherdecks.net and mention you heard it on 810. Call now and relax.
Gerritsen and Toth presents The Shift with Jack Johnson on ESPN Kansas City, 1510 AM and 94.5 FM.
Another day, another edition of The Shift on 94.5 FM and 1510 AM ESPN Kansas City. I'm your host, Jack Johnson, alongside Marco Marquez. Shout out to our presenting sponsors, starting with Gerritsen and Toth. They handle the most complex felony, federal, or state criminal defense cases. You'll find they've been doing that successfully, helping criminal defendants all over the Kansas City area and Northeast Kansas for years. Also a shout out to Active Family Chiropractic. If you're dealing with any neck, back, shoulder, or any type of pain, go in today and schedule an appointment. Their office is located on 135th and Antioch in Overland Park. Or just give them a call at 913-681-6013. That's 913-681-6013. Stop dealing with the nagging pains that keep you up at night and call Active Family Chiropractic today. The Royals lost again to the Arizona Diamondbacks last night by a score of 9-5. And I can't say that it wasn't expected, because the Royals are in a slump right now that appears to be insurmountable. Of course, they're going to win at some point, at least we hope, and baseball usually turns out that way. But you couldn't have started the game much better than the Royals did last night. And even then, did any of us really feel confident? Did any of us, after the first inning, go, I think the Royals are going to be able to hang on? At least not me. Maybe that's me being a little bit pessimistic. I'm trying my best, as you've heard before on the show, to maintain some optimism. And I did say yesterday, which is the truth this morning, that I would feel better last night if the Royals lost but the young guys performed, as opposed to the veterans or the guys that are not going to be here in a month or two winning the game for the Royals last night. But against Arizona, before you could even turn on the TV, the Royals had a 3-0 lead. Three home runs in the first four batters of the game. Nearly four in the first four. Andrew Benintendi flied out to the warning track, but Whit Merrifield put the first pitch he saw into the bleachers in left field. Bobby Witt Jr. crushed his fifth home run of the season. Then Hunter Dozier crushed another one to left field. So off Zach Davies, the Royals took out all their anger from Sunday's loss and put it on Davies. I mean, as they should. You got to be pissed off after games like Sunday in which you blow a 6-0 lead. But the inning didn't stop there. MJ Melendez with a great plate appearance. He walks Carlos Santana. He rips a single to right. And Kyle Isbell smokes another hard grounder. By the way, did anybody know this? I saw Bally Sports put this up last night as the Royals were talking about it. That is Ryan and Rex. Kyle Isbell has a top five hard hit percentage in baseball. Yeah, I think he's going to be playing every day from here on out. At least you can only hope so, because I know the Royals like to construct their own type of lineup on any given series. But Kyle Isbell drives in the fourth run of the game, and the Royals immediately have a 4-0 lead. But even as great as that felt to see the offense performing, I'll tell you this. The offense does look different with Alex Zumwalt in the dugout. It's not immensely better, but you can see certain at-bats and certain players thriving now that maybe there's a different voice in the clubhouse with both Alex Zumwalt and Mike Tosar. Kyle Isbell seems to be one of those guys. MJ Melendez, I mean, really, the most impressive thing about Melendez is he's not going up there. What I thought would happen when Melendez came up is pitchers are going to be able to expose his plate approach. Now, this is why I have so much confidence for Vinny Pasquantino and Nick Prado, is because all three of those guys, Melendez, Prado, and Pasquantino, in the minor leagues, had a very advanced approach. They were not chasing a lot of pitches out of the zone, and they'd crush the pitches that they did want to hit. And that does change at the major league level, but I thought at least early on Melendez would be a little bit over anxious, knowing that I have to take advantage of a role in which I may not have it for a while. Cam Gallagher's hurt, but he will come back at some point. And then Salvi got hurt. But he kind of stays in his own. He has his own plate approach, and it's the same one he had down in AAA. Now, he's not hitting the way he did last year, but still, he has the best chase rate of any Royal right now in the lineup. And that's saying something. That's a guy who has less than 100 ABs. Hell, he has less than 80 ABs. And he's probably got one of the more professional approaches of anybody in that lineup. So Melendez, since becoming the everyday catcher, I think we felt pretty good about what we've seen from MJ Melendez. But back to the game, immediately once the Royals have a 4-0 lead, Arizona strikes back for three in the bottom of the first off Zach Greinke. And Greinke didn't have his best outing, and against the NL West this year, he hasn't been very good, both against Colorado and the Diamondbacks. It didn't feel like that ballpark favored him. The ball was jumping off the bat, and he wasn't able to locate as well. He walked four guys last night. Did strike out a season-high five, but Zach Greinke allowed seven earned runs in 3 2/3 innings. Now, I think the most frustrating part of last night, if you were tuning into that late game, by the way, I still do some work for Royals Review, and I have Monday recaps, and I got to tell you, I hate West Coast games. That, and especially last night, a damn near four-hour game, and knowing that the Royals are not coming back in the late stages, it's brutal. It's not the latest game I ever covered. I think the latest game I ever had to do a recap for was the Royals played Oakland back in 2019, I want to say it was. Maybe it was 18. 2018 or 19, they're playing Oakland, and it went into like 12 innings, and the game started at 9:05, and it didn't end till like 1:30. And I was still in college at the point, and I was like, I got class tomorrow, and I got to stay up covering this game. Now, the Royals did win, so it was worth it. But last night, that was a late game. But probably the most frustrating part about this is the Royals scored one more time after the first. They got a run in the fifth, run in the second for their fifth run, thanks to Whit Merrifield just kind of being Whit Merrifield. He stole second, wild throw to second. He went to third because nobody was covering. The Diamondbacks tried to throw to third, and it was overthrown, and he was able to score on one play, on a couple of errors by the Diamondbacks. But that was it. The Royals never scored again. And though the bullpen did its best to make up for Greinke, Yoel Piamps, who's probably now garnering some good trade interest. His ERA is down to 1.31. He worked 2 1/3 scoreless innings. Colin Snyder, once again, he may be getting close to another stint in Omaha. Though Colin Snyder's been great this season, it feels like, the last couple outings have not been good. His ERA ballooned to 5.51 after allowing two earned runs on three hits and 2/3 of an inning. Matt Peacock did get Colin Snyder out of a jam in the seventh, but at that point, the Diamondbacks had a 9-5 lead, and the Royals really didn't have much of a chance left. They did have a outside chance of making it interesting in the top of the eighth. MJ Melendez came to the plate with the bases loaded. However, I don't want to blame the umpire for this game, but Corey Blazer was really bad last night. And in that inning, when the Royals were trying to make a comeback, he made a brutal strike three call on Bobby Witt Jr. with first and second and one out. It was clearly down in the end. Wasn't even close to the zone, by the way. And Bobby Witt was called out in strikes. Then later in the inning, MJ Melendez is to the plate. He watches the first ball, and his base is loaded. So you know in that spot, as an umpire, you can't be given gimme calls. Now, the Royals got one on Sunday against Minnesota, and I still think that's bad for the game. You don't want to bail out a pitcher that's all over the zone. But MJ comes to the plate, and then on a 1-0 count, once again, a ball that clearly misses the zone, down and in, and it's called a strike. So that's where it could be 2-0, where now a pitcher is forced to throw it over the heart of the plate, or at least in the zone, but now MJ's down, or at least even in the count, 1-1. But he has a different approach than he would have had at 2-0. But nonetheless, MJ Melendez, he flew out to center field, and it was on a hanging slider, and that's a pitch where I think the more comfortable he gets to the major league level, he'll be able to crush because he has that type of power. Now, I know you follow this count, Marco, umpire scorecards. Do you want to take a guess how many runs, based off calls last night, Corey Blazer went to Arizona? This is one of the most shocking scorecards I've ever seen. Worse than any Angel Hernandez scorecard I've seen.
Really?
Because the way they impact it is, when are these calls made? So if you make the worst call of the game, but yeah, there's nobody on and two outs, you're not going to get many additional runs. This is like, I've never seen a scorecard like this.
You know, it's funny. I was watching the game last night, too. Did you get that feeling, especially when Bobby Witt Jr. Was called safe when he was out by a step at
first
base? Oh,
yeah, I was like...
I was shocked he called him safe, but it's like are we getting to that point now where the Royals are so bad they get the bad crews together?
Because maybe
there was just something off yesterday about the whole umpire crew. But all right, so runs that
it's runs overall favor. That's kind of their stat here. It's overall favor. So how many runs they give to a certain team? So usually, an additional run is a bad night for an umpire. Anything under that, it's usually the norm.
Mm-hmm. An additional 4 runs then.
Okay, not that high, but Corey Blazer gave Arizona an additional 3.2 runs last night.
Wow.
Because two of his most brutal calls, impactful missed calls on this scorecard, were with Bobby Witt Jr. with runs at first and second with the Royals down by 4, mm-hmm. and MJ Melendez at the plate when he got a bad strike call on a 1-0 count. And they factor that in because, you know, Bobby Witt Jr., if that pitch is called a ball, it's bases loaded.
Mm-hmm.
It's bases loaded and one out. You're getting a run probably in that scenario.
Probably.
And for MJ, yeah, you'd think. I mean, the Royals have butchered a bases loaded, nobody out situation, so maybe it's being too generous to the Royals' offense here. But that was a bad night. And this is, once again, I'm not going to sit here and point the finger at Corey Blazer why the Royals lost the game. You had a 4-0 lead, and it took 3 innings to wipe away that lead. The day before, it took 2 innings to wipe away a 6-0 lead. Is that not something that stands out? And I feel like we're on a broken record here. I feel like I'm talking to a wall, not knocking you, Mark. I feel like I'm talking to a wall when speaking of the Royals front office. They're not going to do anything. Because in reality, Cal Eldredge shouldn't have been able to make that trip. And is Cal Eldredge the centric part of all this, all these problems? Is he the main focus? Maybe. I know a lot of us are pointing the finger at Cal Eldred because the pitching staff is so inconsistent, and you have outings like Sunday and you have outings like last night where most teams that are trying to be competitive, that doesn't happen. That shouldn't happen. Yet, Dayton Moore blatantly told the media and the fans that everybody has accountability until accountability runs out, and I can evaluate this team after 40 games. Dayton, we're 41 games into the season, and they're 14-27. They're going to be in last place in the American League Central if this keeps up. Now, there is a positive in this year, right? You have some guys that are going to be able to be flipped at the deadline for prospects. I like what I've seen from majority of the prospects, at least the hitting prospects, which I was a little bit concerned with going into this year. And I wanted to see how MJ Melendez, how Kyle Isbell, how Bobby Witt Jr. could transfer their talent to the big league level. So far, so good. But there's been so many wrongs with the pitching staff. Yeah, Brady Singer's been great. Yeah, Brad Keller's been great. Daniel Lynch has been good. I'm not going to give him the great label yet because he's had some very bad outings. But there's been some guys now where we can completely, nearly write him off. I don't want to. But guys like Chris Bubich and Jackson Coar in Omaha right now are severely struggling. And they're at a level where they can't really be struggling at this point in their career. We want to say young all the live long day that, oh, give them time. You know, they didn't go through Double A. They didn't go through Triple A. Well, Chris Bubich made the jump from High A to the big leagues. I get all of that, right? And this isn't really their fault. It's the Royals' mismanagement of how they handle prospects. They rush guys. And though the fans, we all clamor for, man, put Bobby Witt Jr. on there when he's 20 years old. You know, put Brady Singer on the roster right out of the draft. Put Asa Lacy on the big league roster right after a couple of outings in Quad City. That just can't be the way it goes. You have to trust the developmental coaches down in the minor league system to get them to where they're ready. And listen, we're not scouts. We're not any of those developmental coaches. But it's clear that they were rushed. Chris Bubich, rushed. Jackson Coar, rushed. I don't think Brady Singer was rushed. And I don't think Daniel Lynch was rushed. So far, it's worked out. Bobby Witt Jr., not rushed. MJ Melendez, not rushed. Kyle Isbell, don't think he was rushed. Maybe last year, you want to say, being on the opening day roster and opening day starter was a little bit early. But now they're getting into the point where when you rush them, they may not be able to get that confidence back if they can be a big league ballplayer. One of the worst handlings the Royals have ever had in Dayton Moore's tenure was Adalberto Mondesi. An absolute atrocity when handling a young prospect. And for some reason, the Royals felt like with Mondesi, just with his defense alone, not really there with the hitting tool yet, that Mondesi could be an everyday big league player when he was 21 years old. And that wasn't the case. They butchered his developmental process, and now he's going to be screwed up. And he has been screwed up. Now, injuries are a factor, but you look at his approach at the plate, it's completely off. It's like a low-A hitter or a high-A hitter was just thrown into the big league level, which is what happened to him. He was in Double-A Northwest Arkansas, but he was thrown onto this roster in Game 3 of the World Series. There was no need for Adalberto Mondesi to be up there. Then the next year, it was, okay, in August, he's going to be an everyday player now. Then the year after that, there he is, the opening day starting, the opening day second baseman for Kansas City on a team that was still trying to compete for a playoff spot. They rushed him. Now Chris Buich and Jackson Coar, they were rushed. They were bad teams they were on, but clearly they weren't maybe needing that level yet. Now Jackson Coar, you may want to argue with, okay, he was dominating AAA, and I get that, but clearly something was off because that wasn't able to transfer into the big league level. Now there's two things that could happen here. Maybe it was the Royals' developmental process, or Jackson Coar may have more of a mental block. That in AAA, he knows he's not really pitching in front of a fan base, in front of a crowded stadium, a sold-out stadium, where it matters, you know, what the Omaha Storm Chasers do. Yeah, you want to see the Storm Chasers win, but, you know, when the Storm Chasers lose, do any of us in Kansas City, like, bat an eye, really? It sounds bad to say, but no, we're more worried about how do the prospects look? What did they do in the game? And Jackson Coar dominated, and he probably knew, well, everybody wants me in Kansas City, but then when you get to Kansas City, you have that pressure of, I got to perform. I got to be a star just like I was down in AAA. And maybe we do want to hold out hope for guys like Jackson Coar and Chris Buich. Now, in baseball, not every prospect works out. It's very possible that of the Royals' 2018 draft class, Brady Singer and Daniel Lynch are the only two top pitchers that thrive. Now, maybe Jackson Coar never figures it out. Maybe Chris Buich never figures it out. It's more so, though, of what can the Royals look at and what's the problem? You know, where is the problem with this organization? Is it the major league level? Is it in AAA, AA, high A, with the scouting department? What is it? And right now, when the Royals are 14-27, we all want to point the finger that the reason the pitchers struggle is Cal Eldred, and I get that. I don't think Cal Eldred's very good at his job. And though Dayton Moore may tell you otherwise, J.J. Piccolo will tell you otherwise, it's clear that the same problems that have been happening since Cal Eldred took over, they're continuing to happen. Royals pitchers can't get ahead. They can't throw strikes. They work themselves into jams, and they can't get themselves out of it. We've never really had a situation where the Royals pitching staff, for 2 or 3 months, they look like a strong, dominant pitching staff. And honestly, they've got arms in that rotation that can make them a strong pitching staff. I can only imagine what Daniel Lynch can become without Cal Eldred. I can only imagine what even, let's say, Brady Singer, you know, maybe even Chris Buich, some of the guys in the bullpen, what they can become without Cal Eldred. But when's the end point, right? When do we look at this team and we say, all right, enough is enough? Yeah, you fired Terry Bradshaw, but that was kind of a no-brainer. The team got shut out in 3 games out of 5. I mean, there was a lot of bad games for this offense, situational hitting, and guys were struggling. It made sense. And if Terry Bradshaw wasn't connecting with the players, it makes sense. If Cal Eldred was certainly connecting with the players and making good adjustments, the Royals pitching staff would be pretty good, would it not? I mean, I think this is a very telling sign that the Royals have talent in their bullpen and in the rotation. It shouldn't be like this. And I think the most frustrating thing is a lot of the Royals pitchers, it's not even about not having your best stuff. They might not even challenge a hitter. You know, every time it gets to 3-2, do we feel like a Royals pitcher is going to get an out whenever it's 3-2? No, you kind of feel like it's going to be a walk or it's going to be a hit. It's just, it isn't going the way for the Royals right now. And you want to stay positive. You want to say that at some point, they're going to be fun to watch. And I think they will be when a lot of the more younger guys are up. But there's still fat that needs to be trimmed at the major league level. And I think it can change this team in the long run. Now, in the offseason, you got to reevaluate. You got to reevaluate your front office. You got to reevaluate everybody on that coaching staff. And are you where you want to be? And if you're not where you want to be, you have to make the tough decision. Because fans are tired of sitting around and saying, well, just wait. Wait through the process. Wait through the rebuild. The Royals are 5 years into a rebuild. And can we say with confidence they're much better than they were in 2018?
No, we can't.
Exactly.
Because Royals review showed us that we can't.
They are the exact. They have the exact same record, right? 14-27 they did in 2018. One of the worst Royals rosters ever accumulated. That was a bad roster with no rotation, by the way. Danny Duffy was banged up, and it might have been hell who. I remember Blaine Boyer was on that team. Ian Kennedy was still starting. It was a bad, bad team. Brian Flynn, Justin Graham. I mean, there was not much to work with. Yet that Royals team has the same amount of wins as this one does. That's telling. That's a sign. That's when you say, all right, we're probably not where we want to be. You have to look yourself in the mirror. We said that yesterday. I'm going to say it again today. At the end of this season, can you look yourself in the mirror? And this mainly goes to John Sherman. Can you look at yourself in the mirror and say, Dayton Moore, J.J. Piccolo, Mike Matheny, they're going to get us back to the postseason within the next 2 years. Can you believe that? If you can't, find somebody that can. And until then, I think you're going to lose a lot of the support from Royals fans. Now, some of us, like Marco, like myself, like Shane on ESPN, Wichita, they're going to stick around no matter how bad the team is because it's baseball. But you're going to get that same frustration, and the fans that you want to stay around, the ones that maybe are used to good Royals baseball and the slim time it was there, they're not going to want to go to the games anymore. People aren't going to bring their kids out to the ballpark when the team just isn't very good. And right now, this team is not even remotely good. It's not even a small fraction of being a good baseball team right now. There's good players on the team, but overall, as a cohesive unit, the team's not good. When you can't hold 6-0 leads and 4-0 leads, and in fact blow them in 2 or 3 innings, you got some problems. You have some internal problems, and you know what? Am I really crazy in saying, Marco, last thing I'll ask you on this, am I really crazy in saying, I have no issues with the players. I have no issue. Yeah, you can point your finger at Carlos Santana. You can point your finger at Ryan O'Hearn. They're baseball players, right? They're going to turn around at some point. They're going to hit. They're going to be fine. I'm putting this blame on the coaching staff. All of it, in fact. All of this blame is going to go on the coaching staff for me because this roster has too much talent to be one of the worst rosters, or not worst rosters, worst teams in Major League Baseball. Because I don't want to say rosters because they have good players, but the overall team right now, statistically and record-wise, they're one of the bottom ones in the league. They can't be at that level. And so can I, Marco, sit here and say, I'm not worried about the players. I'm really not. Yeah, some guys struggle, but are we really shocked that a 36-year-old first baseman is not going to hit that well?
Yeah.
No, I'm blaming it on front office and coaching for where the Royals are right now this season.
No, and it's really good that you said that, too, because it's not on the players. The players, they're just doing what's asked of them. They don't write themselves into the lineup card. Anytime they haven't been in the lineup, there hasn't been a feud, at least that we know of, where it, you know, Santana pulls the veteran card and, hey, I get what I want because I put in my years and I'm getting paid sort of thing. No. If anything, it's been Matheny that's told us we're going to play the guys that we're paying. And so it's the front office and of course Matheny that are under the microscope right now. The players are there to play. You can tell that the young guys, Witt, Melendez, are enjoying it, but it's one of those things too where, listen, they don't want to go. If I were getting started out in my major league career, I don't want the next 5 years to be what it is right now with this Royals club. Just like every team, just like every MLB player, they want to play for a bad team. They want to play to win, and I can see that competitiveness with. How about this? I see more competitiveness out of the players than I do with the coaches and some of the front office people. It's one of those things where I hear you're telling me you guys want to win, but you're not showing me that you want to win in some ways.
Yeah, they're not at all showing the fans, everybody covering him, that they're trying to win a lot of baseball games. They may be trying to win every single game when they actually put the team out there, but it's about moves you're making. And I think right now the moves that have not been made, that's what's costing this team a 14-27 start. When we come back here on The Shift, we'll be talking some Chiefs football. It's been a while, but you know what? It's too sad to be talking all Royals right now. So we will do some Chiefs football when we come back here. You're listening to The Shift on 94.5 FM and 1510 AM ESPN Kansas City. Welcome back into The Shift on 94.5 FM and 1510 AM ESPN Kansas City. I'm your host, Jack Johnson, alongside Marco Marquez. Marco, I heard you in the hall earlier. You watched Raw last night. Eddie Murphy's Raw?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so thoughts? I don't think I'd gotten the chance to ask you about that before. Where would you put it up there now in ranks?
As far as stand-ups?
Let's go with...
Or...
I mean, comparing them to the Netflix stand-ups you've seen in all time, I guess just in your top five?
Ooh. Nah, not top five. Because I was talking to Curtis Siebold about it. Because I watched Delirious. I thought Delirious, which was Eddie Murphy's first stand-up, was better than Raw. Gabriel Iglesias is Hot and Fluffy. That's such
a good
one. That's a classic one that I... Man, I laughed so hard when I cried of laughter when I watched that one for the first time with my brothers. Let's see. Kevin Hart. There's two. I'm not little, I'm grown or something.
I think it's that. That's like his best one. I think that's by far and away his most famous one, or at least has the most memorable bits.
Right, where he talks about his teacher, and he does his impression, like, the one that put him out there pretty much.
Yes.
That one's always a good one. And then of course we talked about George Carlin, the late great George Carlin.
Came out with the documentary, right?
Yeah,
on Netflix.
Yeah, on HBO Max.
HBO Max.
So
that's
what's good. HBO. If you're looking for stand up content, like
they
just want to watch Netflix, especially, but even older stuff, HBO Max does too, because they got the HBO specials. Dave Chappelle, Chris Rock. It was funny. It was good, but I think it wasn't a top five for me. But
would Delirious be in your top five?
Yes. Yeah.
I was gonna say I'm with you that I'd take Delirious, and we're talking about stand up comedy right now, a sports show, but it doesn't matter because they're in the middle of summer or getting in the middle of summer, and the Royals are nearly in last place.
Hey,
camp's far away.
That
too.
Game was a joke last night, man. Because I was watching, so I had the Heat and Celtics because there was an hour in between the start of that game and the start of Royals, so I had that one on my phone. We're watching stand up. That game is over in the first quarter. And then I switch over to the Royals, and of course you're thinking, "Oh, okay, yeah, 5-0. That's a great start. I just saw back-to-back-to-back home runs. This is good for the Royals. Royals are winning." I was trying to think of a tweet last night, Jack, and maybe you could help me out with the thought process of it. But I had never seen like two just bad teams very like complement each other so well each time, because you had the Royals just knocking the socks off Davies. And then you had some fielding error. Then you had the elementary school triple three stolen base run by Whit Merrifield because of the Diamondbacks defense. And then, of course, Greinke giving up. He didn't give up all five. He gave up three of the five. Anyway.
Seven earned.
Oh, Snyder didn't give up.
Snyder gave up the last two.
Oh,
so
I see.
It was seven from Greinke. Pyamps worked. Was fine. Peacock and
goes to show you. I turned it off once it was 5-5.
I don't blame you,
because at that point
it was old and...
you talked about it in your monologue. It's talking about when the Royals are in a hole or put themselves in a hole. How much confidence do you have as a fan that they're going to get out of it? That goes to show you. I turned it off. I turned it off at 5-5. I was done.
Yeah. But to your point, it's like that's the worst part. It's also what I'm trying to convey to people listening right now. Is the best time to do sports radio by far and away. It's the easiest. The best time of the year is you have the end of the season in the NFL and you have college basketball. And for that matter, you have college football going on as well. So I'd want to say it's right around, would that be November? Yeah, November. November is the best time for sports radio. You get college football, the tail end. So you're getting close to conference championships. You're getting close to bowl week. Then in the NFL, you're right near the tail end of the season, and college basketball is just starting. Honestly, the summer, though, it's great for everybody. You're going out, you're doing fun stuff, you're going to the lake, maybe you're just spending a lot of time outside, maybe you're going to a lot of baseball games. Well, that's all fine and dandy, but for content, and though this show's only an hour, you look for anything you can get. I tell Marco every day after the show, I said, man, I'm hoping we get some breaking news tonight or tomorrow, just because you can only go on and on and on and talk about a baseball team that's in last place and is 14-27 so many times until something new happens, right? How many times does anybody want to hear me go over and over about Cal Eldred? Kind of a broken record at this point, right? You could only say so much about Cal Eldred. Now, maybe it's therapeutic for you all. It's therapeutic to hear somebody bash a Royals pitching coach, but it gets old, right? And that's why it's like we sit here and we talk about stand-up comedy, because it's like, it's because something, or segue it into something. Now, I did say we were going to talk some Chiefs football, but even the Chiefs right now, still a couple of months away from training camp. But I guess we can start with that and what this outlook is going into training camp. We know the position battles, right? We know that the Chiefs have a newer wide receiver group. We know the expectations for that wide receiver group. But Marco, I think this is a good one to go back and forth, you and I, before we take a quick break here near the top of the hour. Who is there in that rookie draft class right now that's not getting enough recognition that you are most excited to see going into training camp?
Oh, man. Not receiving enough, because I feel like all the Chiefs, you know, everywhere Chiefs, they recognize all the rookies because of how exciting of a class it's going to be. But national-wise, really only Karlofkis is the one that has been standing out. So, and Kennard, of course, too, with the hype going around him as a day three pick. One I'm most excited for, it's Brian Cook, man. I'm just excited to see it because this is really this is the type of safety that is going to have a lot of upside. And it's kind of similar to the situation that Juan Thornhill was in, a second-round pick, the second pick by a team in the second round. Same position, of course. Juan Thornhill now on a rookie contract. I'm just curious to see where they fit him in because there's so many different assets in this secondary right now for Kansas City. And I think that the safety room specifically with Justin Reed and Thornhill and Cook, there's a lot of potential there to become an elite safety for the Chiefs to have a pretty good names in their safety room. So he's somebody that I'm just curious to see where he fits in this defense and whether or not is he going to be a special teams guy too. Because when I'm telling you, man, when I heard the phrase a heat-seeking missile plays like that, that tells me he can play anywhere on the defense. And I'm just curious to see where he fits. And of course, Cincinnati's defense was one of the best defense in college football this year, along with Georgia. So that's another thing. The secondary of Cincinnati, there was guys outside of Sauce Gardner that were getting into that top 100. We're top 100 prospects going into the draft. And so it's really just a curiosity of where he fits on the defense, where Spagnuolo chooses to place him, but also just want to see him hit somebody too. You know, I think the same could be said about a lot of different players on this team, offensively and defensively. But Brian Cook especially, he impressed me with his post-draft presser, what I've seen with the tape. Listen, it's this defense this year, secondary-wise, we're not used to seeing chief safeties specifically play with a physical stature. I guess Tyrann Mathieu did at times, but they just got there's a different feel around this safety group. And something tells me that, and I think we talked about this when addressing the defensive line. You know my feelings on it, that they may just go with what they got right now and might make any additions, because something tells me that Brett Veach, he addressed the secondary a lot more this offseason than he did the defensive line. Now, he went out and got some big names for that front seven, but he went out and got a lot of names for that secondary.
Certainly. And that's one thing that I've been mulling over a little bit, and why we, at least myself, I was panicking about, man, who are they going to get, right? They're rolling in right now. Before the draft, it was Frank Clark, Chris Jones, Derek Nnadi, and Mike Dana, the same exact starting four they had last season. We know how bad that front four was. Now, they add George Karlaftis, and you go, all right, how much better do we feel? They're not making moves for Jadeveon Clowney, who went to the Browns. They're not making moves, likely, for Robert Quinn. They're not going out and getting any big-name edge rusher yet. So this is probably the group, but do they deserve the benefit of the doubt right now? Do they deserve the benefit of the doubt of, let's see how this front four is? Or do we look at it and say, no, you don't deserve the benefit of the doubt because last year's front four that you stayed home with, you said, no, we're going to be good with this group. It wasn't good. So do we feel like Brett Veach and the scouting department, do we let them say, all right, this starting four, Karlaftis, Derek Nnadi, Chris Jones, and Frank Clark, we'll go with that, right? And we're okay with that. Or do we say, no, this is going to be bad from week one because you have a rookie being paired with a injury-prone Frank Clark to be the main providers in providing pressure off the edge. I mean, where do we lie on that? Is it? I feel like we're at a spot where weeks one through three, if they're getting the quarterback less than 20% of the time, people are going to be furious because the Chiefs did not make any moves in the offseason with the money they had to go get a big-name pass rusher.
Yeah, I think we've given the benefit of the doubt right now because of what Brett Veach was able to do with the offensive line last year. He's shown us that he can make significant changes with just an offseason. But you're right. They're going to that position group not making any moves from now till the start of the season is going to be under the microscope because that was kind of the biggest headline going into the offseason, but also they addressed it with unproven talent. Proven talent at the college level, but not at the NFL. Not in the NFL. So that's going to be the eyes are going to be on the defensive line going into training camp. Hell, even OTAs that start Thursday. But also, I give them the benefit of the doubt right now. But again, each year, it seems like Brett Veach isn't afraid to make a trade. They got 12 picks in next year's draft. Also, maybe that's what they're waiting for. I can't remember how long it took for them to move on Melvin Ingram, but the same can be done this season also. And absolutely at that point, too, we will know what went down with Orlando Brown, whether he's playing on the franchise or he's extended. So you'll have a better idea of your cap situation at the season also. So, yeah, they could not make a move. They could probably not make a move until they see how it goes once the season starts.
And last question I want to ask you before we go to break and come back with some fact or fiction. Is the linebacker group right now with Willie Gay, Nick Bolton, and Leo Chenault, is that the strongest part of this defense, or is it the secondary? Because we know it's not the defensive line.
I want to say they also have another linebacker coming out of that they signed from Carolina this offseason also.
Yes,
Jermaine. No. That's probably, people are forgetting his name. Jermaine Carter Jr. I think the linebacker group is the best part of this defense right now, which is good because that's the middle part of your defense. There's a lot of youth at the other spots, but there's also veterans there, proven veterans also. But as far as from just looking at it top to bottom, I think the linebacker group is the best part of this defense going into the season so far. But the potential, man, oof. If Karlaftis and Trent McDuffie are immediate starters and are playing at, or you know, get some ground underneath their feet through the first 3 weeks and are actually playing some damn good football, this defense has a really high ceiling potential wise, but it's not there yet. It's not there.
It certainly does have a high ceiling, and that's probably the most encouraging thing because they're so young, and you know that if it is turning out to be a very aggressive, very hard hitting, very athletic defense, you feel good about the next couple of years because they're going to have to be with how strong the AFC West is. I just want to see – it's a wait-and-see game for this defensive line, but I'm super high right now in this linebacker group. I think it's going to be one of the best linebacking cores in the NFL because Willie Gay, great in coverage, Nick Bolton and Leo Chenault, great run-defending linebackers, and Nick Bolton got better at the end of the year at defending and coverage. So if you get Leo Chenault in that group, those are three uber-athletic guys that – are going to cause havoc for a lot of opposing offenses.
Yeah, and I think your linebacker group right now, also bench-wise, is looking a lot better than the days of where, remember, Dorian O'Daniel never saw the field, and then Ben Neiman. So I think Hey, we talk about the defensive line being something that needs to be addressed. They improved at the linebacker position, and they improved in the secondary, and that's really good for Kansas City.
When we come back here on The Shift, we'll finish up with some fact or fiction. You're listening to The Shift on 94.5 FM and 1510 AM ESPN in Kansas City. Welcome back into The Shift on 94.5 FM and 1510 AM ESPN Kansas City. I am your host, Jack Johnson, alongside Marco Marquez. We're going to finish up now with some fact or fiction. Five questions, five takes in under 5 minutes. Marco, fire away.
Jack, fact or fiction? Heyo. MJ Melendez wins a Silver Slugger at catcher in the next three seasons.
You know, I will say that the catcher's position is the easiest to win the Silver Slugger award because they're not asked to be these ridiculously high-powered offensive catchers. Salvador Perez was one of the few because he clubbed 48 home runs last year. But I feel like MJ Melendez has the type of potential to be like a 25-plus home run guy. And with that OBP, which we see could maybe transfer from what he did in AAA to the big leagues, he has a good shot. It's a matter of when. When do you get the best version of MJ Melendez? Is it in the next 3 years, or is it in the next five, or is it in the next 10? I'm going to go fact on this, though. I feel like MJ Melendez in the next 3 years is going to have one of those breakout seasons where it kind of is the passing of the torch of, okay, Salvador Perez for so long was that catcher, that silver slugging catcher. Now you have an MJ Melendez who is going to be an even better defensive catcher, so I'll go fact on that.
Fact or fiction, the Royals have a losing streak of over 10 games this year.
See, usually 10-game losing streaks, as crazy as it sounds, they happen early on in the year. They happen in April. They happen in May.
Last year, 11 games in May loss.
Yeah. Yep, and it was ugly. It was bad and didn't make you want to turn on the TV at all for Royals baseball. They've had so many 5-game losing streaks, though. It feels like every other week there's a 5-game losing streak. 10 is a lot, though. Over 10 is a lot of losses in a row. And I feel like, as bad as it sounds, we're enduring the worst part of the Royals season right now. Mm-hmm. I do not think, though, once again, Buddy Bell's been mentioned twice this week, and it's only Tuesday. I think when we get to July and August, we're going to see a much better Royals team than we do right now. I think right now, it's kind of a mixture of just not having the right coaching staff and still having some guys that are not producing enough. So I'll go fiction, not over 10 games, but we'll see some losing streaks about 6 or 7 in July and August.
Fact or fiction, Leo Chenal grades out as the best of any Chiefs linebacker this season.
You know, I'll go fiction on this, though he was, I think, the highest graded linebacker, or at least run defending linebacker in the Big Ten, if not college football, I believe. Mm-hmm. That coverage grade is going to hurt him a little bit. Just his first year, and especially in the first couple weeks, we saw that with Nick Bolton. You know, Nick Bolton, though he was great against the run, I think the highest PFF grade he could get was like a 65 or 66 because he was not good against the pass just yet. However, when you have Willie Gay out there on the field, and as long as he's healthy, he is going to be, for the most part, your highest-graded linebacker because he's so good in coverage. So I'll go fiction, but I do think Leo Chenal will be the best run-defending linebacker they have on the team, and that's even over Nick Bolton.
Fact or fiction, Trent McDuffie breaks Marcus Peters' rookie interception record.
Okay, I think Marcus Peters had, like, 8 or 9 that year.
Yeah, yeah.
It was up there. And now, Marcus Peters, I believe, is a different type of cornerback than Trent McDuffie is. Marcus Peters was all about the interceptions. Marcus Peters was not into the coverage part. He wanted to ball hawk a little bit. Trent McDuffie, I don't think, is going to be like that. I think he's going to be a very physical press corner. So I'm going to go fiction. I mean, that was a ridiculous year for Marcus Peters.
Yeah.
But I'll take more of a coverage linebacker than one that's just picking up all the interceptions.
He benefited from not having any film on him.
Exactly.
Lastly, fact or fiction, Jason Tatum is the best player left in the NBA playoffs.
No, fiction. I think he's probably the... I'll go third best. I'll go either Steph and Luka, it's damn close, then Jason Tatum, then probably Jimmy Butler would be the top four for me, but not the best remaining in the NBA postseason, so I will go fiction on that. There is Ray Charles, so it's time to go. That wraps up another edition of The Shift on 94.5 FM and 1510 AM ESPN Kansas City. I've been your host, Jack Johnson, alongside Marco Marquez. We'll be back tomorrow at 10 a.m. You take it easy, Kansas City.